Professor Warren debunks a few healthcare myths.
We're Americans. We like to think we're the best at everything, right?
We're always the best at this, right? Okay, so here are two of my favorite myths. The first is, if I have health insurance, I'm safe. I'm making a payment every month. And, you know, I think there's even a little element of, I'm making a big payment, so I must be really safe. Nobody reads a health insurance contract until you've been denied coverage. And so what my research shows and others' research shows is that health insurance is some protection, but not nearly as much as people think. The idea that those out there who have full health insurance are safe if they get sick is one of the biggest myths in the system. The second biggest myth in the system is that our current scheme overall gives us the best possible results. There are some really embarrassing data about how much better Canadians do, how much better Europeans do, how much better the Japanese do in certain kinds of health outcomes, in part because they are not using a private fee-for-services system of delivering their health care. The fact that we're going broke to pay for our health care does not mean we're getting the best health care. So, what else? Ask me to explain thermodynamics, and I'm in big trouble. I'm going to stutter and kind of stumble around and drop my chin.
Here we go.
This stuff, I know. The data didn't show these tiny little differences and slight problems. The data were like an iron frying pan that would clunk. Families going broke because of health care payments. Got it. The reality is that half the families that filed for bankruptcy last year did so in the aftermath of a serious medical problem.
I think for many Americans, there's a bit of a, you know, sense of false security. You know, they say, well, I'm not one of the 45 million uninsured, and right. I have insurance, and I'm not going to get sick.
So let me tell you a story. When we were studying the families who filed for bankruptcy, I'd done enough with these families to know we were going to hit a lot of medical problems. Still, I was surprised that it was more than half of the families in bankruptcy. But here was the finding that really blew me away. 75% of the families who ended up in bankruptcy in the aftermath of a serious medical problem had health insurance at the onset of the illness or accident that ultimately landed them in bankruptcy. They had health insurance. In other words, they had played by the rules in every possible way, got a good education, got a good job, bought a home, had health insurance, and yet the system is so misdesigned in terms of how big the bills can be and how narrow the protection from health insurance is. The people we interviewed, many of them had put second mortgages on the house to pay the surgeon. Many of them had run up $40,000 and $50,000 in credit card bills to be able to get the therapy they needed, to pay for the drugs that they needed. They now had the kind of bills, the kinds of changes in their lives that meant they're going to lose it all. They can't pay off the second mortgage on the house, particularly the ones who are still sick, or the ones who are still at home trying to nurse a child who's sick or an elderly parent who's sick. So they get hit. It's like a 1-2 punch. They are less likely to be able to earn the incomes that they need to sustain themselves at the very same moment that the outgo, the bills, just go through the roof. There's a huge amount of financial misery that we have imposed on middle-class American families. And that financial misery stems from the fact that they get sick and they are now at risk for losing it all. They can lose every bit of it. The old life you once knew will be gone.
And what is the reason for that change? I know there are many reasons, but if you could just...
The two changes took place over the last generation at the same time. The first is that what we could do in the healthcare field just It just exploded. It just went beyond anybody's wildest dreams in terms of outcomes, in terms of techniques, in terms of new devices to try, and in terms of what it cost. And what didn't change on the other side was finding a way to pay for it. We left the same old creaky small health insurance system in place. We left in place a system where literally billions of dollars are drained out to pay for the administrative costs of a health insurance system, to pay CEO fancy salaries. We take healthcare dollars and spend them over on administration instead of taking all of the healthcare dollars and spending them on the cost of buying the actual health care. The message is beginning to leak out. No one is safe. You have health insurance, it'll make you a little safer. But anyone shy of the multimillionaires is just not safe.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and we're continuing with six people debating the motion, It's Wrong to Pay for Sex.
Arguing against the motion, Sydney Biddle Barrows.
Thank you. Freud once asked the question, what do women want? And I would argue that what women want is their own money. But what's interesting is some of the statistics that I've been hearing, because what's interesting is the only people that you can get these statistics from are the people at the very, very bottom. And they constitute a very small percentage of all of the working girls, at least in the United States. I cannot speak for anywhere else. And because I have to tell you that I don't recognize any of the kinds of clients that the opposition has talked about. I don't recognize any of the kinds of girls that the opposition has talked about. So let me tell you a little bit about the experiences that I had. First of all, most of them are students. I did not hire anyone under the age of 19. No one I know, and I know dozens and dozens and dozens of madams, ever hires girls under the age of 18. Never. I only took 40% of the young ladies' earnings, and they wanted to give that money to me. They didn't have to, but I took the phone calls. I'm the one who set it up. I'm the one who checked them out. I'm the one that made sure they got the money. If for some reason, you know, at the end of the evening he didn't pay, I would still pay her. And can I tell you something? In 5.5 years, you should pardon the expression, we never once got stiffed. And we got and we got the money at the end. So let me tell you about Colby. Colby was the daughter of a doctor. And she was used to living a very privileged life. She was in medical school, and she had several siblings who were either in college or medical school or law school or whatever. And Colby had a thing for, you know, beautiful clothes. $600 boots is actually the example she gave to me. And she came to work for me because she felt guilty asking her father, who had so many other, you know, of her siblings in school, to give her $600 for a pair of boots. This was Colby's choice, but this is the reason she worked for me, so that she could have $600 boots. And I know a lot of people are going to find this offensive, but I don't think there's one single solitary girl that worked for me who didn't come back after the very first time and say, I can't believe it was so easy. I can't believe I didn't do this before. I know this is offensive to some people, but may a lightning bolt come down. This is what they said. Now, when you figure that what we used to euphemistically call the nitty-gritty only lasted maybe 5, 7, 8 minutes, and yet the clients kept the young ladies for 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. What were they really paying for? A lot of them pay for the company. They pay because they want a pretty girl to talk to and to have a good time with. I had a couple clients who had invalid wives who felt that it was cheating if they got a girlfriend, but they still had needs that they need to have met. So while it is true that there are a lot of bad people out there doing bad things to girls, I think to say that all of these girls are abused, that all of these girls are taken advantage of, that they're all traumatized, yes, there are some, but it's certainly not the majority. And I want them to throw away the key on these people too. But I think to tar everyone with the same brush is just not being realistic, because there are a lot of good people out there who are doing this. And to criminalize these girls and to give them records so that they can't go and live a normal life just to me doesn't seem right.
Sydney Biddle Barrows. Thank you. And that concludes round one of the debate tonight. As things stand now, 20% of you are for the motion, it is wrong to pay for sex, 50% of you are against, and 30% of you are undecided. We will have you vote again towards the end, and we choose the winner depending on which side has moved the most votes.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
The 2012 campaign is here, and boy, has it been fun. We are looking at the candidates and where they get their money.
The dough is overflowing, and when all is said and done, we suspect they will have spent enough to buy a third world country.
The super PACs are out of whack, excessive and atrocious, supported by the billionaires whose checkbooks are precocious.
The TV spots are piping hot, they're nasty and ferocious.
This kind of toxic politics is hitting a new low.
Shus. This whole fundraising mess began with Citizens United.
The rule came from our highest court, though many tried to fight it.
The pundits are complaining that the process has been blighted,
'cause that hand feeds the Congress too, and they don't want to bite it.
Now incumbents' lips are smacking, 'cause the money is humongous.
Let's send them super packing when we end this little song, yes?
No chance at all, they'll change the law, so let's all take a long breath.
Remember, the word progress is the
opposite of Congress.
And now back to the debate. It's wrong to pay for sex.
So we're going to move now onto round two. And in round two, the debaters speak directly to one another, and we also take questions from you. But I want to kick off the questions first by turning to the panel and saying, after hearing the opening statements, I feel as though I'm hearing two teams debate two entirely different worlds, one in which In one of these worlds, prostitutes are workers. In the other world, prostitutes are captives. In one world, prostitutes have free choice. In another world, prostitutes have no choice whatsoever. Catherine, you had said that there really is no free will. If you are a prostitute, it is never your choice.
I didn't say what you just said. I said that it's always in a context of sex inequality in which your options are precluded to begin with. You know, prostitution is what women do when all else fails, and all else fails often. And there are a lot of things that men do in general when all else fails, and prostitution is not that thing. And that means this is an institution of sex inequality. It is. But I would also note that we actually agree, that is, Ms. Barrows and us concur in the view that the prostituted people need to be decriminalized firmly. That is the Swedish model. And it's the buyers who we're here to talk about, the Johns that Melissa described, and whether what it is they are doing when they are buying people.
Your teammate, Melissa Farley.
I would like to quote, to respond to what Sydney said and quote from her book, which is, she said, a call girl is simply a woman who hates poverty more than she hates sin. I would use the word prostitution and not sin. So I would say a call girl is simply a woman who hates poverty more than she hates prostitution. I think that's the whole point we're making here. That shouldn't be the choice. If we're seeking an end to inequality between men and women, if we're seeking an end to violence against men and women, women should not have to make the choice between poverty and education, paying the next month's rent, and prostitution.
From the other side, Lionel Tiger.
I'm sorry that this whole discussion now is focused on prostitution. I thought that what we were talking about was the economics of human sexuality. And that is really the parsimonious, fundamental issue that we have here. People engage, and I mentioned the engagement ring, in marriages, which have immense responsibilities to the next generation, to communities, to relatives, to friends. And we're somehow putting the immensely complex and both luxurious and difficult business of being an adult lover into the same rubric as prostitutes who, And I think there's an argument to be made that, yes, it's terrible. Now we're starting to hear how this all expresses sexual inequality and racial inequality. Please, let's try to limit the discussion to the subject of human sexuality and stop including every single allergic category that comes into these
What Lionel is doing is saying that buying a diamond ring is paying
right.
for sex.
Yeah, I'd like to. Yeah, I think it's actually the negative team that is equating marriage and dating with paying for sex. The negative team is conflating things that should not be conflated. First of all, in prostitution, there's no shared desire, right? Which means one person is an object. That's a big difference. Also, marriages in which there is a transactional element, in which it's, okay, you give me this, I'll give you this, there's a 50-50 exchange of services, end up failing precisely because that's not what a marriage is, right? But I want to address the free choice issue because Ms. Barrow said that she doesn't recognize any of the girls or the men. So I just want to refresh her memory because I thought her book was really interesting. And she said, quote, quite a few of the new girls that she used had no money and nothing appropriate to wear. So I would take them to Saks and charge whatever they needed on my credit card. They would pay me back from their future earnings. When she found a fabulous ground floor apartment for her office, which was super cheap, the rate was made up for by making her girls sleep with the landlord, who she said was only interested in one thing and lived in a seedy, semi-furnished apartment and made them feel cheap. She says the girls weren't crazy about the plan, and really one can see why. Is that free choice?
Tyler Cowen, you want to come back to that?
Our moderator is a very objective fellow. And what he's pointed out is that there are many different worlds here. And this is true. The other side is asking for a blanket condemnation of a practice. It is a diverse set of situations with many entirely acceptable outcomes, a lot of very bad outcomes, and the other side is simply pressing the emotional buttons again and again and again. And I urge you to resist that, to stand back, look at the bigger picture. In my view, the correct answer is to side with us.
Tyler, you're saying sometimes it's okay to pay for sex.
There are many instances where the practice is badly regulated and we observe bad outcomes. Trafficking is an example. None of us are defending that, but that's not the proposition.
Is there a sometimes? Tyler Cowen is arguing that sometimes it's okay to pay for sex. Not using the word quadriplegic, but that was implied, that somebody who may not have an opportunity for another sexual experience and therefore hires a prostitute. Wendy Shalit?
Yes, I'd like to address that because I think those are really important points that he raised. If you show me a man who's handicapped, I will give you a man with the same disability who has a woman who loves him. And women are not that superficial. And there's a lot of women who love men. And if there's somebody who's using prostitution as an excuse, I think that's a problem.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. The motion up for debate is, it's wrong to pay for sex. Stay with us.
A question from the middle of the aisle. Ma'am, your turn.
Norma Ramos from the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women. My question I would like to have addressed by Dr. Farley and Catherine McKinnon. We keep hearing that the solution is better regulation. I'd like you both to address what the real experiences are in the countries such as the Netherlands and Germany that are regulating the commercial sexual exploitation of women, which we at the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women referred to as the world's oldest oppression.
Catherine McKinnon?
Yeah, Germany is actually thinking about the Swedish model at this point, having discovered that a tremendous amount of trafficking is produced by the draw of legalization. And that's the same as in the Netherlands, although they're not considering the Swedish model at this point. What happens is that the men who want to buy all the things that are abusive and dangerous and destructive to the women go to the ever-exploding illegal industry around it, right? So you legalize it in the name of having a well-regulated prostitution industry, and exploding around it is the illegal industry for which there is no legal structure to address for all the men who, to begin with, want to have sex without condoms.
Tyler Cowen, your opponent, does that mean you have been arguing that it can be regulated to safety?
It can be regulated.
Apparently he's a lot smarter than, you know, several hundred years worth of other people who have tried to regulate and who have a million different ideas about how to do it.
Tyler Cowan.
I spoke at length about New Zealand. There's a several hundred page study about the experience, which I have read. The other side has not uttered a peep about this. And even in the example of Germany, it's just been admitted the real problem is the illegal trade, which should in some way be decriminalized. The European model can be improved. But for the most part, the Western European model has worked better than what we do right here. This is widely understood throughout the world.
Melissa Farley.
I actually have read the New Zealand report. And in New Zealand, the Maori people are prostituted much younger and much longer, and they're more frequently homeless. So we again have that situation in New Zealand of a special class of people who
are
Melissa, more vulnerable.
But Melissa, are you saying that regulation can never wipe out abuses, or do you just not like the idea anyway?
Here's the answer to that. It's counterintuitive. It's been tried, and it didn't work. The mayor of Amsterdam said, we thought it would work to regulate. Well-intentioned people thought it would work to regulate, and it didn't. They're shutting down over a third of the legal brothels in Amsterdam right now. Why? Because of 80% of the women in Dutch legal prostitution are moved there from economically stricken Europe, and because there's organized crime that's out of control. Legalization is a pimp magnet. So, I mean, that's the answer. We know that it doesn't work. It's been tried.
Lionel Tiger, who argues against the motion, wants to pick up on that last point.
This is not exactly a trivial issue, and I'm afraid it's being reduced in its importance into a sentimental kind of grab bag of victim complaints.
Why sentimental?
Well,
victim complaints.
Because it's easy. Essentially, what I'm trying to do here is get the argument into the larger context of human sexuality and away from a relatively, again, sentimental concern. There was just, if I may make one final comment on this, there was recently the publication, and we've known in the primatology trade about it for years, that it turns out that chimp males who hunt will give meat to women who...
To women?
Females, maybe, to female chimps. But the fascinating thing is that it's not just a quid pro quo, because these become sustained and durable relationships in which the male is a consort and an associate of the female, even when she's not in estrus and therefore sexually available. And that it's kind of haunting, because it suggests that this is actually a more elegant phenomenon than just giving meat to a female.
Okay. I see Wendy Shalit is quite anxious to come in on this.
We're not debating whether it's common to pay for sex. We're arguing whether it's right or wrong.
He said, son, have you seen the world? Well, what would you say if I said that you could just carry this gun? You'll even get paid. I said, that sounds pretty good. Black leather boots, spit shine so bright. They cut off my hair, but it looks alright. We marched and we sang, we all became friends as we learned how to fight. A hero of war, yeah, that's what I'll be. And when I come home, they'll be damn proud of me. I'll carry this flag to the grave if I must, 'cause it's a flag. I kicked in the door, I yelled my commands. The children, they cried, but I got my man. We took him away, a bag over his face, from his family and his friends. They took off his clothes, they pissed in his hands. I told them to stop, but then I joined in. We beat him with guns and batons, not just once, but again and again. A hero of war, yeah, that's what I'll be. And when I come home, they'll be damn proud of me. I'll carry this flag to the grave if I must, 'cause it's a flag that I love and a flag that I trust. She walked through bullets and haze. I asked her to stop, I begged her to stay, but she pressed on, so I lifted my gun and I fired away. And the shells jumped through the smoke and into the sand that the blood now had soaked. Collapsed with a flag in her hand, a flag white as snow. A hero of war, is that what they see? Just medals and scars, so damn proud of me. And I brought home that flag, now it gathers dust, but it's a flag. Said, son, have you seen the world? Well, what would you say if I said that you could?
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.